Good afternoon. Today is the 5th of October, 2010. Baker Hall, the Emilia Island Museum of History. The following interview is being conducted as part of the Emilia Island Museum of History's Heritage Keepers Project. We are interviewing Mr. Neil Frank. Mr. Frank, would you give us your date of birth, please?
My date of birth is February the 21st, 1941.
And your place of birth?
Jacksonville, Florida, Brewster Hospital, Jacksonville, Florida.
Thank you. My name is Gene Kendall, and I will conduct the interview on behalf of the Emilia Island Museum of History. Assisting me is Alex Buell, who will operate the recording equipment, and also may participate as an assisting interviewer. Again, thank you very much for agreeing to the interview. I will now begin the interview. Thank you very much. Mr. Frank, first of all, we thank you for your decision to open up your life to tell us about how things were primarily in Fernandina. But from a historical perspective, could we get about a minute or so of a quick thumbnail of the things that you see that were significant from now to the present, and we'll come back specifically to talk about Fernandina.
Well, the things that I see, growing up, I grew up in what is known as Old Town, which is that was platted by the Spaniards, I think, in 18, I'm not sure of the date, but anyway, I was in original Fernandina, Old Town. My family, on my mother's side, the last name was Trei, as far back as we go back in the early 1800s to this island, and my family on my mother's side, roots go back to Spain. We all grew up Catholics. I grew up in St. Peter Claver Church and St. Michael's. St. Peter Claver is now closed, and St. Michael is there, but since then I've joined the Episcopal Church. But back in the day when I was a young adolescent, teenager, everything in this town, everybody, it seemed to be, we did everything together in Old Town except go to school together. That is, as far as racial black and whites goes, we played ball together, we swam together, we visited one another's houses in Old Town, but we did not attend school together. Integration didn't come until the late 60s. I was long gone. And back then, the fishing industry, shrimping and fishing, was flourishing. And to me, as a whole, there seemed to be a more spreading of the wealth than what it is now. Now it doesn't seem to me to be as much spreading. There's not enough jobs. Let's put it that way. We're not shrimping anymore. We're not fishing anymore. So therefore, the people have to find other jobs. And the jobs to me today is not, in comparison, of not paying as much as it did back then, and a lot of people are suffering. I'm disappointed. A lot of our young people are not attending colleges, in my opinion, at the rate that they were seemed to be back then on the island. And I just wish that we could mainly correct that. We need our young people today to go to college and get all of the education that they can get, and hopefully they'll fall into a successful career.
Well, wow, that's not a thumbnail. That's a lot of stuff that we got to talk about. So, well, let's begin. You say on your mother's side, it was Trei.
T-R-A-E-Y-E.
And do you know what part of Spain that...
As far back as, I think some of our family members trace it to Mallorca.
Mallorca?
Mm-hmm.
Beautiful.
And the family, it's in the Archdiocese Library in St. Augustine, and they were, I think some of the family came over as servants or something, and there is some Trei families that came through St. Augustine, and the name did change. The spelling of the name changed. T-R-A-I-D, I think, was the original spelling, and somehow as time evolved, it changed to Trei. But we did trace it to Mallorca, Spain, through St. Augustine, and to Fernandina Beach.
Wow, that is fascinating. You grew up Catholic.
Yes.
St. Peter Claver and St. Michael's.
Yes.
And
St. Peter Claver is on the corner of 2nd and Calhoun. 3rd and Calhoun, I'm sorry. And St. Michael's is on the corner of 4th and Broome. Mm-hmm. Now, I love telling this story, especially because there was nothing that was written, but that's the way it was. St. Peter Claver was considered the black Catholic church. St. Michael's was considered the white Catholic church. But we attended both. And if Mass was held, I'll use a time, I guess back then, I don't remember exactly, but if Mass was held at St. Peter Claver at 8 o'clock in the morning, on Sunday morning, the black sat in the front and the white sat in the back. And then Mass was held at St. Michael at 11 o'clock. The white sat in the front and the black sat in the back. Nobody ever told me that's the way it was, but that's the way we did it. I remember as a kid going to St. Michael, and one of my uncles, he had the car, so we would ride with him. And I, as a kid, I sat up front. I didn't think nothing of it. No one's in the church said anything but him. He came up front and got me, but nobody else complained. So I guess a lot of time we segregate ourselves and we don't have to.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. You mentioned in your beginning statement that school was really the only enforced segregation, let's say it that way. Where'd you go to school?
Peck. I went first to St. Peter Claver. We had a school there. St. Peter Claver School is located 2 blocks on Calhoun, 6th and Calhoun. I think it's a nursery there now, or a kindergarten. There's a little 2-room building there. It was right down from St. Michael's School. That's where the blacks, and each row was a different grade. But at my age group, I was the only child at my age group in the old town. And so I only went there for 1 year. And the public school had busing. St. Peter Claver didn't. So I wind up after the second year going to Peck High School, because other than that, I would have had to walk from Old Town to St. Peter's Claver School. So that's the reason why I stopped going to the Catholic school and went to public school at Peck High School, because of busing.
About how long? Okay, because of busing.
From second grade right on through 12. Peck High School went from first right on through 12. There were no, you still had your elementary and your middle grades there, but we went from first. There wasn't that many kids here on the island then, so they went from first right on through 12 at Peck High School.
Okay. The what were your favorite stories about school?
Well, I can go to any number of. When I first started Peck High School, ironically. Well, even before Peck High School, we had a Catholic nun. Her name was Sister Cotel, and don't ask me how to spell that because I really don't remember. Sister Cotel, she was a strict disciplinarian, and she had a 12-inch rule or whatever it was, and she would crack you across your knuckles if you didn't do what she said you should do. And a strict disciplinarian she was, and she taught music. She was a piano instructor for a lot of the kids that wanted piano lessons. And then when I went to Peck High School, my first teacher in second grade was Miss Willa Mae Ashley, who to this day is still living, and she's still not teaching and getting paid for it, but she's still teaching a lot of kids, her graduates. There's about 100 who've graduated through her. Stop by to see her. Some have written books, some haven't, but if they come to Fernandina, they stop by her house and see her. And she was one of my favorite teachers at the Peck Center and for the Peck High School, that is. And then later on, Johnny Robson, he was an art teacher, and he was a terrific artist. In fact, his son right now is the bandmaster at Fernandina High School, and he also was my coach. Johnny Robson was the first football coach at Peck High School. I wasn't in the first football team, but later on, he still remained assistant coach. My head coach at the time when I started playing football was Nelson Paul Williams, who was a terrific coach, and he was a great father figure, and he probably instilled more in the young men during my time there than perhaps, I won't say the rest of the teachers, but he did make a great impact on me for my life. He died about 3 or 4 years ago. He's no longer with us.
When you left Peck, what did you do?
Well, when I left Peck, I started Bethune-Cookman, but my Bethune-Cookman University, now Bethune-Cookman College, Nelson Paul Williams was the coach. He took four of us. Four of his football players down there, and we all was trying to get a scholarship, and the only one got a full scholarship, but they wanted us, being a church school, a Methodist school, Bethune-Cookman didn't have money to afford for full scholarships, and they wanted us to stay on campus during football season. The football season was over, move off of campus. But my family, I knew that. I never even consulted my mother, didn't have the money to afford me to stay there. So I didn't stay. I chose to go north and move to Cherry Hill, Merchantville, New Jersey. I had relatives there. And I started working for RCA at first and several other jobs in between, and I wind up working for a company called Budd. That's BUDD. It's a large automotive stamping plant. It's the UAW. Edward G. Budd was a partner of Henry Ford. Budd had the stamping plant, and Ford had the assembly line. In Philadelphia, Budd had when I started working there, there was probably 4,500 to 5,000 people. The corporate office was in Philadelphia. And then they moved to Troy, Michigan. But I spent 15 years in the union with Budd, the UAW, and 16 years in management. So 31 years altogether. And I got out with 31 years, 55 and out, early retirement when they were changing the guard. So I saw the handwriting on the wall. So I took an early retirement, and they paid me a year not to work, and I got out early retirement.
And came back?
Came back to Fernandina. We made plans. My wife is from Philadelphia, but we bought a house here in 1988. I retired in 96. We bought a house here and rented it out with the intention that we would move down here. And so when the opportunity came that I could get out of early retirement, my wife is a registered nurse anesthetist, and she was pushing the issue more than I was. She wanted to come here. And so we made the move in 96. Our son's last year of high school in New Jersey, he went to Holy Cross High School in Delran. And he came down here, and we moved down here, and he sort of fought his tooth and nail. He didn't want to move, but he went to school down here and at Florida A&M, and he's since moved to California. He lives in Oakland, California, and doing well. And so we've settled in here, in Fernandina, my hometown, which I love every bit of it.
You mentioned your wife was pushing to move back down there. How did she get introduced to Fernandina?
We've been out here on several vacations, and sometimes you're vacation a place, and a vacation you don't have a time really for it to settle in. And she, after we bought the house, and the house is right a block and a half off of the beach, right off of Fletcher, and so she wanted to move down here, nice little neighborhood, and swimming pool there, a lake there, and you could walk through the ocean. And she knew that she could get a job being a nurse anesthetist. It wasn't a problem with her finding a job. But the biggest problem she had was adjusting to the culture, the difference. It took her several years before she really felt like she was a part of the Floridian way of doing things down here. And now she's doing everything. So we made plans to do that, and things work out pretty well.
Okay. Yes. You mentioned the fishing, the shrimping industry, and you also mentioned the wealth seemed to be spread out better, and the pay was better. We're going to touch on all of those sorts of things, but tell them, you know, I had heard that your father or your grandfather was active in the fishing industry something.
My grandfather, I did not know too well. I was 2 years old when he died. He was a shrimper. And he was well liked by everybody. Growing up a youngster, I used to hear people talk about him. But my father was the first licensed porgy boat captain that, especially on the East Coast that we know of. The porgy boat captain years ago before, they were not required to have a license. And so when that time came, I don't remember what year it was, they had to have a license in order to operate the Porgy Boat. And so he was the first licensed black captain on the East Coast that I know of. He was born in a small place in Brunswick County, North Carolina, called Shallotte, S-H-A-L-L-O-T-T-E, Shallotte. And he was born in 1900, February the 10th, and he died in 1994, so he was 94 years old when he died. He was the oldest of 16 children by his father's first wife, and his father married again and had 10 more children. He left Shallotte, he told me, about 16, when he was 16 years old, and moved south, and he was introduced to porgy fishing. Now, in Old Town, there were three what we call porgy plants. Porgy is the fish, I guess, as a lot of people know, but there's also shad and menhaden, which is in the porgy's family. And the plants in Old Town, the first one that you get there was called Smith. The second one was called Corbett. The Corbett family still lives in Fernandina. Jim Corbett, a very good friend of mine. And there was another plant called Quinn. And on during the summer months when the fish was plentiful in the ocean, each plant would have perhaps maybe five or six porgy boats. Some would have more, some maybe have less. But each boat would carry perhaps maybe 400,000, 500,000 fish. Some would carry 700,000. And the fish, when they catch them, they would bring them into the plant and they would cook the fish, and the fish meal was used for fertilizing for the farmers and also feed for the cattle. And the oil was extracted, was used in some of the foods and stuff that we eat in perfumes. That was really, when I say the money was spread, because when the boat would come in, the high schools here, I didn't do it, but some of my friends before me, they let the high school out and they would go work the boats in order for the boats to get unloaded with the fish for the boats to go back out the next day. And so the younger people, there was not an age limit, so to speak. If you were big enough or tall enough, they would hire you to help out and find a job, and you would work and help, and you'd have money in your pocket during the week. So that's what I mean. And the shrimp, the same way. The entire docks on the waterfront here in Amelia looked nothing like it did back then. All of the docks was warehouses and net houses, and the shrimp boats would come in. It would be, I don't know how many, maybe 150. I'm guessing, I may be exaggerating a little bit, but as a kid, you didn't count the boats. But when the shrimp boats come in, as a kid, you could go down there 10, 11, 12 years old and head shrimp. And at that time, back in the 50s, they would pay you maybe 2 cents a pound, 3 cents. Well, no, I don't think it was 3 cents a pound. But even before my time, my mother told me that they had some of the docks down there. They would can the shrimp, put them in jars to be sold in other parts. I never saw that part of the deal. But all of that was work for young people. I mean, that's what I mean. The wealth was sort of spread. And if you didn't have money because you didn't want to work, I mean, it was there for you at certain times of the year, and you could always find something to do. And going back to the porgy boats, the shrimp boats, they may carry a crew, including the captain, maybe two or three people. Some just have two, they may have three. But the porgy boats, I'm not sure exactly. I think a lot depends on the captain and how large the boat was, as to how many crew. I know it could be as many as 26 men on the boat, which includes the captain, the mate, the cook, the engineer, and then the crew itself. It probably run maybe as many as 30 men. And back during the day, when I say things were integrated, my father had whites and blacks working for him. The captain chose who he wanted to be in his crew. Mm-hmm. And he had he was well liked, and some of the old timers today, if you happen to talk to them, they call him Captain Neil. Some call him Captain Smokey. He used to smoke cigars, and he had a story to tell everybody. He was full of stories, and so he worked for Quinn, and he worked probably for all of the different mills here, and he would go as far up as New York, Amagansett, Long Island, and they had plants up there, and Beaufort, North Carolina, I think Atlantic City, New Jersey, and Monmouth, New Jersey had a fish plant, and Virginia had one, and I know Beaufort, North Carolina, I'm not sure about South Carolina. Georgia didn't have any, to my knowledge. But now, to my knowledge, there's only one on the East Coast, and that's in Reidsville, Virginia. Both in North Carolina, I think that plant closed. but it was a dying industry, and the industry sort of moved to the Gulf of Mexico. I have a cousin who was a smith, who was probably the largest in the country at the time in the production of the fish meal and the oil. Philip Mosley, he lives in Port Arthur, Texas now, and wonderful. If he was here, he would really give you a great interview, because he knew all these people who grew up with him. He quit high school, I think might have been 10th grade, and working for Smith, and later became a superintendent of Smith plants. And he flew all over the country, including he spent 9 or 10 years in Peru operating a plant for them.
Where is Philip now?
He's in Port Arthur, Texas. Mm-hmm. And he's in very, very good health, and mind is good. So if he ever come to town, he would really be the one. The porgy industry, a company called Zapata bought a lot of the fish plants out there. I think Zapata was actually owned by the Bush family. And then some lawyers bought the company. And so now, most of the fishing now is done in the Gulf. They have a few plants. I don't know where they are, maybe Pascagoula, Mississippi. There's none in Port Arthur, but some other places. But in South America, a lot of it's still being done. And they're using the anchovies more so than the porgies, because he told me the anchovies is more oil and it's more profitable. And they have smaller boats in some areas. In some areas, they have boats now to carry 3 million fish, and they process them right on the ocean. So everything has changed.
You mentioned that did you ever work? Never work.
I went out on the boat several times just to watch them. And that was an interesting thing when they were out there, what they call purse seining. The larger boat carried what they call two smaller boats. We refer to them as purse boats. And the captain would get in one boat. When they would see a school of fish, they had what they call a striker boatman, a small boat, the guy would row the boat into the school of fish. Because when the captain and the mate is up in the crow's nest, we call it, they could see the school better. But when you're down on the water level, more or less, you can't see the well. So when they see the school of fish, the striker boatman would cut a loose from the big boat, and he would row his boat right into the school of fish. And that way he would be the guide for them. It was like shooting at a dart. And then the purse boats had the net, half in one boat, half in the other, and they would come out and they would circle the school of fish. And then, I guess maybe 12 men in each boat, or maybe more, they would start pulling the net and gathering the net, and they'd be singing. What was old spirituals and work songs that you hear on the railroad? And my father could really sing. They would love to just hear him sing, whether they're working or not. And they would gather it in, and then the big boat would, once they gathered in as much as they could pull it in, as tight as they could get it, the big boat would come alongside. And back then they had a big scoop, looked like a big dipper. And they would, and they had a big net around the circular part of it with the drawstring, and it had a long pole, like a long straight tree, and they would dip it into the water, and when it get filled up, the crane would hoist it up and go over the hole of the boat, and the guy would let it loose, and that's the way they did it back then. But later on, they developed a vacuum. I guess the vacuum probably was maybe a foot and a half or 2 feet in circumference. And then they would pull. They would gather them the same way, but then the big boat would pull alongside the fish, and they would drop this big hose, like a big fire hose or something, right into the water and suck the fish out. The fish would come out one way, and the water would go the other way. And that was quite experience out there. And the guys would be singing the songs, and it was pretty spiritual out there. That's some of the songs that they would sing. And it's the funny. They would catch a lot of other fish too. They would get a shark would be in it sometime, and they'd catch a king mackerel and a bluefish and other fish, edible fish. And when you see them, once they put them in the hole of the fish, you could see them, and you could take them out, and people would be waiting to bring back to give the fish away. But it was a strange thing that you could never catch a porpoise, even though he'd be in the fish, and they would hate to see that. And all of the boats that I knew of, the pilot had 22 rifles, because once a porpoise get in there, if he didn't jump out of there, you had to shoot him, else you would lose that setting, what they call. And if you were close to Fernandina Beach, you were up in Jekyll Island, or anywhere, once the porpoise he would circle a net, and it was a fun thing watching them, how smart they are. They would circle a net, I guess feeling, trying to find a way out. And if he couldn't find his way out, he would go underwater and jump up, I don't know, 10 feet in the air and come back down. And once he do that, the net splits. And that means the dead fish that you've already gathered, they've already probably drowned or whatever takes place. And then they would float ashore. And you're responsible for cleaning up wherever the fish came ashore at. So the guys, they didn't like to shoot the porpoises, but they had no choice.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's interesting.
Yeah.
You're going to have to help me with this. As a lad getting to see that firsthand, I still don't understand why that wouldn't draw you to the sea, why that wouldn't make you say, I want to do this.
I had the opportunity. My father asked me if I wanted to do it, but it was a lot of hard work. I mean, it was those guys, there were no gloves to use. When you're pulling that net in the salt water and the brine, and your hands were, you know, thicker than normal, and a lot of the old timers, they used stuff on their hands, but it was hard work, and the sun out there on the ocean and the salt, and 100 degrees is 100 and sometimes 110 out there on the ocean with the sun beaming down on you. And even when I would go out there, I would help the cook sometime in the galley when he was cooking the food and other than that, but I never worked on one and never really wanted to. Sometimes I look back and say maybe I should have tried it, but I.
Do you know what the fishermen made? What their wage was?
The wage, I can't tell you exactly, but they made a lot of money. One gentleman who just he had the oil company here. His name was Hugh Stone, and I knew him as a kid, but he didn't know me. And since I've been back here now, he just died about 3 or 4 years ago. I was at the car wash. Okay, you were asking about the wages. I cannot say exactly, but the captain was responsible, and he had a bookkeeper, someone keeping up in the mill would tell him how many thousands or how many millions of fish they caught within a week times. And sometime when fishing was bad, they didn't catch much, so the men were the company they worked for would still give these men a certain allowance because they only got paid if they caught fish. And sometimes after a week passed, they may have a million and a half, 2 million fish, which is a very good pay. Now, what's a very good pay? I can't tell you exactly, but the gentleman I mentioned was on the oil company. They used to get the oil from Gulf Oil. I think Hugh Stone was the name. He just died a few years ago. And I was at a car wash, and I introduced myself to him, and he started smiling and shook my hand and was telling me what a great man my dad was, and he's so glad that I let him know who I was, and we were sitting there talking, and he said, you know, back in the 50s when your dad was the captain of the boat, Ronnie, he said, your dad was making more money than the superintendent of the paper mill. That's what he told me. Now, whatever that was, I don't know. But my dad is, he, even when a certain, they fish seasons, and you didn't have to go north if you didn't want to go, or you didn't have to go in the Gulf of Mexico, but he also was a what they call a red cap. That's the trains. A lot of tourists come to Florida, and the trains in Miami. He would had his own, always on his own car, and he would drive people from the train station to take them wherever to go, and doing luggage just like Sky Cap at the airport. And something else I didn't know until before he died. He told me he promoted a lot of entertainment throughout Florida. He told me he said people talk about the Depression. He said he didn't know what they were talking about, because he said people wanted to be entertained, and whoever the entertainers were back then during the Depression, he was booking them in places in Tampa and Miami and wherever, and that was also a part of his doing the entertainment. And then later on, he told me when in Miami back in, I don't know, was it the early 40s or what, he said Candace Bergen, the movie star, her mother was married to Edgar Bergen. He said he drove her from Miami to Asheville, North Carolina. He always bought LaSalle's back then, and then changed to Buick's. When they stopped making LaSalle's, the Buick, the same company, General Motors made LaSalle and Buick, and then he always had had the nicest of cars, and that's what he did. He always had a hustle going, if I use that term, doing something to make some money.
Your dad, you mentioned the 40s and 50s, so when was your dad a hoagie boat captain?
It was in the early 40s. Now, it was to be exact, I should have gotten that date. But he, the Coast Guard didn't require a license until later. So it may be on that, what I gave you, that's when they required a license. But he was the first. But it was in the early 40s when he became a porgy boat captain.
Mm-hmm.
Back then, doing some old stories. I learned a lot of stories from guys that worked for him and fished with him. And when the boats would come, even they would come from, say, Mississippi, and they would come and they go through the intercoastal waterway, somehow work their way around. They'd be going up to the Carolinas and on up to Atlantic City, perhaps. And he would bring the boats through. And a lot of segregation, especially in Georgia and South Carolina, even in Florida. Like you pulled into the harbor here in Fernandina, just for an example. Other places out there, when they see a black captain and a black crew, you couldn't tie up to the docks.
Mm-hmm.
So in certain areas, this is what some of his crewmen has told me. As he said, when he got to those areas, and they had to buy food to survive, you know, as they go along the trip.
Mm-hmm.
He said he would come into to one of these places where the dock captain would tell him he couldn't tie up, and he would pretend that he couldn't hear. He would do this. And meanwhile, he said he would tell the crew, throw the line off. He said, Captain, I can't hear you. Captain, I can't hear you. I'm hard of hearing. And meanwhile, the crew is tying the boat up, and he's getting off the boat to talk to the dock master. And the dock master, meanwhile, he's hollering. He said, Doc, I couldn't hear you. I'm hard of hearing. And the man said, well, stop talking so loud. He said, I can't help it. I was born next to a junkyard. And that, he said, we need food. He said, we can't. We got to have food. And he wouldn't let nobody out talking. If it was something crucial to getting what his crew had to have. And then different other guys, there was one guy, Herbert Christopher. Christopher's out of New Berlin, but very fair skinned. I think they had some Portuguese in him or something. But Herbert Christopher, if you're looking at him, you would, not knowing him, you would think he was white, but he was a black family, but very fair. And to my knowledge, I know Herbert drank a lot, but he was very quiet. And in some places they would go, when they were pulling into the dock up in I use the Carolinas again for example, he would tell Herbert, because if they saw a black captain, they would give him more trouble of tying up to the dock. He would tell Herbert, say, Herbert, you'd be the captain. We docked the boat, you're the captain now. So you, and Herbert never say too much, but he had the cap on, he'd probably be half tilted. And Herbert would dock the boat and act like the captain, and then they would get whatever stuff they needed, and they start back on the journey. When they're going back, sometimes they have to go into the ocean, go back in the bar. The guy would say Herbert will still be at the wheel of the boat, and he said he'd tap her. He said, Herbert, you're not the captain anymore. You can step back. And so the guys would have me laughing. And another story, they were lost. I think this was off the coast of Florida somewhere, and he called the Coast Guard. He said, we're lost. I don't have my, well, I guess, coordinates or whatever you need. He said, we're lost. Would you help us? And so the Coast Guard answered him back. Said, well, Captain Neal, tell me your coordinates. I guess I'm saying that right. You really. And he said, well, Mr. Coast Guard, and my dad stuttered when he talked. He said, Mr. Coast Guard, I'm not trying to be smart, but if I knew that, I wouldn't call you. But he had a lot of stories and to tell people. Even after he retired, the guys on the Gulf, they had the bigger boats then, and the boats always had a pilot. The pilot would bring the boat to collect the fish, and they would send for him just to come down there to tell them stories and sing songs. He worked until he was well in his 80s.
Mm-hmm.
Excuse me, but he was a he tells a good story, and people, and all of the guys down in the Gulf, they, to this day, they love him, and he, his name is on the honor roll down there.
Wow.
Yeah.
Could you tell, is Mr. Christopher, Herbert Christopher, is he still alive?
No, he's been dead a long time. Okay. He's been dead a long time.
Yeah, it sounded like that was some great story.
Yeah. They right on 2nd Street now, the club down, I forgot, it's right on this corner, 2nd and Calhoun. That was an old joint. It used to be called the Club 440. It's called something else now. I'm not sure. Wicked David's or something. Maybe that's. But anyway, right where the big warehouse is on the corner, on the northwest corner of Second and Calhoun, that was the ball field. We played ball there. Well, not the official Negro League, but we played baseball there. And the boats used to dock right at the foot of Calhoun Street, where the docks are now, where the oil company was there. And so they'd be going out 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning, depending if the fish was down. St. Augustine, they became so sort of innovative. They had a spotter. One of the planes would go out and spot the fish the day before, said it. And the fish would stay in the area for a certain length of time. Say if they're down at St. Augustine, or maybe down below St. Augustine, or maybe they're up at Brunswick, or almost to Savannah. So they knew what time they had to leave in the morning to be there at daybreak to catch the fish. And so a lot of the guys that on the boat, they drank in the ball field there, and there was one special character that my dad liked so much. He was from Jacksonville, North Carolina, and all my life we always called him Jacksonville, and I knew his name, but I can't remember it. And he would drink, and he had to go on the ball field before they'd even play ball. He would be the pitcher, the catcher, and run around the outfield. And my dad would always, and Jacksonville would say, strike one or strike two. And my dad would be standing at the backstop, say, no, Mr. Jacksonville, that's strike three. And then Jacksonville would curse him out, say, you ain't calling this game. And it was a big comedy between the two of them. But he would finally come, but he was an excellent, excellent worker. And he was a very, very learned person, but he just had a drinking problem. And that's the way some of the fishermen were, not all of them, a few of them were. And they loved my dad to death because he took care of them and saw that they were paid well for the work that they did for him.
So when did you leave Fernandina?
I left here in 1959, mm-hmm. and I came back in 1996, even though I came back every year, you know, mm-hmm. a couple of times.
So when you left in 59, was your dad still active in the fishing industry?
Yeah. He was still active. He died in 94, and he was 94 years old when he died. He was still active in his 80s, just being the pilot. The pilot didn't have to just bring the boat, you know, pilot the boat. He didn't have no hard work to do, pulling the net or anything. And just once he got on the boat, he just was being the pilot. Take the boat to the purse boats where the fish were, take it back and bring it into the dock. The captain could get a rest. The captain did all of the other hard work, if you call it hard work at the time. The crew did the work, but mm-hmm.
Did he ever own one of the boats?
No one, not any of the individuals, white or black, that I knew back in the day owned the boat. The companies owned the boat, like Smith, Quinn, and Corbett. They owned the boats. In fact, Corbett, later on, and some other boats too, they bought a couple of the Navy boats that were sub-chasers. They told me they were... Like the one boat was called the Air Gannet, one was called the Tracy Carver. They're very fast boats, and I think the Navy used them. They say for sub chasing. I'm not familiar with the military, but that's it. They were very slick boats and fast. Mm-hmm. And then the boats would go out in the morning. So naturally, it was segregated. They still gave the best boats to the white captains, but. Ironically enough, everybody said my dad would catch the most fish still, and they said it's not. I forgot what his saying was. It's not the fastest who get the fish, but it's. I don't know how he put it. Another saying that he had, mm-hmm. but he would. And you need a good crew. If the other boats were fast and didn't have a good crew, it didn't matter. You know, you don't have to stand there and tell each one what to do. Each crew member knew what his job was, and so that helped a lot.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So tell me about your mom.
My mother and father never married. My mother had two children from my father. I have a stepmother here who lived mm-hmm. in Fernandina, and she'll be 94 years old December 16th, my stepmother. And she's in, her health is not the best. She's had a stroke and had a breast removed. But my mother lives in Jacksonville. My mother will be 91 the 15th of this month. The Trei family, my grandfather, who I did not know, that well, because I was 2 years old when he died, lived in Old Town, and they were all shrimpers mainly. It was a large Trei family. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I had one uncle that, he looked like he looked like he was 7 feet tall. He was big. He was at least 6'7", 6'8". Mm-hmm. And they were big, big, strong men, and they were pretty well known around here. Mm-hmm. Also, and my mother later on married my stepbrother, who died several years ago, and he was a tailor. His family was in Jacksonville in the politics, and so so she lives in Jacksonville to this day. And in Jacksonville, I have two sisters and two brothers, and here on an island here, I have a sister and brother here on a me island, and there's two other sisters that live in, one in Philadelphia and one lives in Washington D.C.
Mm-hmm.
So, my mother is, other than arthritis, she's very sharp. Mind's good. Good memory.
Mm-hmm. So, how often do you all get together with reunions? And
well, I was over there. I talked to her twice a day, most every day. I was over there Saturday, took some things to her, and her birthday coming up, so we're planning a little birthday party for her right at home. She suffers when she go out because of arthritis, and you have to put in a wheelchair to take her out. She walks bent over, and when she has to do all that moving about, she really suffers. So, but we and everybody in the neighborhood where she lives calls her mom. Even guys that don't matter what they've done in life, if they've gone to jail and come back, they'll stop by to see her because they always, and they look out for her. Sometimes I'm going there, guys that I don't even know, because I didn't grow up in Jacksonville. I grew up over here, but I used to go over there and mm-hmm. socialize and play ball sometimes. But she's well liked in the neighborhood over there.
Mm-hmm. The what was Old Town like, aside from just, you know, going to school?
Mm-hmm.
What did a young man do, a young black man do in Old Town?
In Old Town, it was just a little seaport community, and it was much more houses out there then than what it is now. It's nothing like it was when I was growing up. And a lot of whites and blacks had houses. We lived side by side. We played ball and where Fort San Carlos is. I know you've seen that. That was our baseball field over there. And when the boys from, I call it uptown, I come to Old Town, we used to go in the swimming hole right down at the foot of Fort San Carlos is a seawall, and we used to go when on high tide, we would come and go swimming, and we'd play baseball. And the Old Town team were blacks and whites, but the team from uptown had all blacks on it. You know, if someone didn't show, then it would mix that way. But Old Town always had blacks and white on the team.
Mm-hmm.
And we would swim together, and we all had rowboats. I say we all families. Some had more than one. Some had indoor boats with little Briggs and Stratton engine inside. Some had what back then we called them outboard motor. We called it a kicker or something. But,
mm-hmm.
And we all swam in Egan's Creek. Out there, Egan's Creek, that bridge wasn't there. And when they put that bridge there, it just messed up the whole area because Egan's Creek was fed by fresh water, and if you're crossing on the bridge out there, on the right hand side was the fresh water came down, and it was like we had that tubes under the road, and you could screws, and you could shut the water off if the tide was high on the right tide was high, you could close the screws, and the right hand side would stay high, and the left hand side it would go out, or either vice versa, and you had a lot of little oases of land on the right hand side. You could take your boat and go around, and we used to go and camp out in there. And trees and alligators were there, but they would go up the creek. We used to swim in there, and no one was bitten during my time. I heard later on that one guy grabbed his arm, but he was a much older guy than I was. He probably was my uncle's age, but I never knew it until probably recently. But no one was ever bothered by an alligator, and they were in the water. We would hit the water, and they would go upstream. They never would. And amazing. It was amazing. We'd fish in there. We all had seine nets and cast nets, and on that side of the way we could go in there and throw your cast net and catch a bucket of shrimp or mullet or whatever was running through at the time. Or even if you had your seine net, we could block a section of the river off and catch a couple of tubs of fish. It was pretty unique. And some of the old timers. One guy had a fish camp, and he taught me, say, at nighttime, you tie two boats together with a space maybe of about a foot or two, and mullet love to jump. He said you shine a light in the water, then mullet jump up at the light and land in the boat. And either you could throw a slice of white bread that would come up and you could scoop them up. And another thing that was illegal they did, at nighttime they would pour gasoline on the water and light it so the fish would go to one end. So you take your net and rope and sort of.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, I'm trying to figure where we dropped off at.
Eagles Creek.
Yeah. Eagles Creek. There were two fish camps down there. One was we call him Pop Davis. His last name was Davis. We call him Pop. Pop was a real. I guess he was a Renaissance type of man. He was really a nice gentleman. Even I didn't have a driver license. I could take his truck without even asking him going anywhere I want to go. I'd help out with the boats and unloading the boats. I made a few nickels and dimes and quarters here doing that. He rented boats to guys that are going fishing out in the backwaters out at the jetties, you know, rowboats, and he had outboard motors. And he had a confection store there selling sodas and different types of drinks and potato chips and candies and snack food. And then there was another
Where was this located?
This was at right at Egan's Creek.
Right there. Right,
there was two sections of Egan's Creek there. See, the road was flat, and they had two tubes at each section, and there was fish camps on the north side, which wasn't maybe a football field and a half apart, and another on the south side of there. Pop Davis and Mr. Peoples. Mr. Peoples was a sort of, I don't know, he just wasn't as friendly as Pop Davis was. Sort of, we didn't cater to Mr. Peoples at all. We'd go in there, but that was it. We didn't do much on our behalf to be congenial to him or he to us. So we felt like we weren't wanting much with him. So we just let it go. Even though he would give a big party every year, big fish fry and things, and some of the old people would do the fish, and that was his contribution to the community. And then there was a couple, Mr. Solomon, who probably owned more shrimp boats than anybody I've ever heard of. I think he's given credit for the modern shrimping industry with the two nets or whatever else they're doing now. He had the big house right there on the corner of between 3rd and 4th on Olachewa. That was his house, Mr. Solomon. It was back then, to me, it was really immaculate, pretty powder blue, trimmed in white. The shrubbery was all manicured, looked like something you see in a magazine. He even had two cars the same color of his house. He had a Chrysler Imperial, mid-50s, I guess. It was powder blue and white, and had a Ford Thunderbird when it first came out, powder blue and white. And I think they say he owned like 150 shrimp boats in here and in Texas, all around. And I guess that was the extent that I can think of now. And he had a big yacht out in Old Town. He kept it in Old Town. He and another gentleman, Jack Woodward, he owned a Chevrolet dealership right on the corner of Dayton and Atlantic, right where the U-Haul place is. It was Woodward Chevrolet. He had a yacht there. And sometime he would get us to help him do different things, and he would pay us. So that's what was on Eagles Creek before they put the bridge in. And it was really, really much nicer, I think, than what it is now. They opened it up, and it just, the salt marsh took over a lot of the area where the freshwater trees were, and the islands there that you could go out and camp out during the day and come back in the evening or whatever.
So that clearly has to be a pretty much of a bittersweet memory then.
Yeah.
How does how would you describe the area now, looking back?
Well, there's a lot. I liked it better back then. I'm not one for living in the past, but I always reflect on the past because I sort of keep up with our history as much as possible, and we have lost a lot of our cultural things that we used to do. We used to, even the netting now, the Burbanks I know have the netting place out in Old Town there at Corbett's place out there. And a lot of people, a lot of blacks and whites back then, in fact, Jackie Delaney's family, they were big in making nets, especially shrimp nets. Right on the corner, the house there was on on the corner of Beach and 11th, and they helped the shrimping industry and other people that. They had net houses here, and they had people that were making nets or repairing nets. If they had the big, the porgy nets, they had, in Old Town, they had the big spools that if the net needed repairing, I don't know how large a spool was, but exactly how many feet the net was, but you could walk inside of the spool. In order to get the net on the spool, you had the crew, and sometimes we as kids, they let us do it. We'd walk the spool, and that means while the spool is turning, it's pulling the net off of the boat. You know, and then if the net had holes in it, then the guys would take the I forget what they called it, the needle and repair it. Yeah, and then they would repair it, mm-hmm. and then they to get it back in the boat. If we were around, we would walk the spool back the opposite way when the, you know, it was dry out. And they would treat the net sometime with some type of brine or something because the salt, you know, the salt takes its toll. Mm-hmm. And that was a fun thing to do. And, mm-hmm. and we used to help out that way. I know Smith had a couple of big spools. Corbett had a couple, mm-hmm. and the other one, they had them right on the water, and some on the intercoastal waterway side.
And so the part of what a young man did was kind of hang out on the docks and find part time work or whatever.
Yes.
What was your favorite thing of all of those jobs that would have been around?
To say that I have had a favorite. I did so many things. Actually, in most of my years, starting in fourth grade, I used to really, for myself, and I did that also on the docks, but I helped a gentleman who was a real, really good family member and a friend of mine. He was crippled, and he had a laundry truck. So I used to run clothes for him. I did that, and he would give me so much money a week to help him just to keep me, you know, buying drinks or whatever it was, just something to do. And that's why I got to know everybody in Fernandina. I mean, that people say, now, how do you remember these things? But when you're in and around town weekly and in and out of people's doors, you get to meet people and you know people and you see things and you hear things other than people that's not getting around. So I got to know everybody in town. And I mean, I don't say that braggingly, but I bet you when I was a kid growing up, I probably knew 80% of the people on the island. Mm-hmm. You know, and to this day, people are, I tell them who I am, and they remember my dad, and they relate to me through him. I know that's what it is. But I just used to like doing things around the, like walking the spools again. That was a fun thing to do. It was fun. We made fun of it, and mm-hmm. it wasn't hard at all. And the guys, they would take us on board the boats and feed us, and they always had a good cook, so we. And a lot of desserts. So
what was the scariest thing, you know, in and around the docks that if you could?
But, you know, when you're young, you don't have stuff enough to be scared. But yeah. you can imagine. Most of the time, the river is calm. But if you had a nor'easter in here and the boats had trouble pulling into the dock, you know, sometimes depending on how many fish they had on board, even if they were empty, you dock according to which way the tide is moving. And so as kids, they would be docked two in a row, and these boats are big, and we would jump the boats like it was nothing, not even in my wildest dream if we slip and fall between them or something. That didn't even occur to us, and no one that I knew of at the time, not young kids, mm-hmm. ever was hurt by jumping the boats, and you look back and say that was pretty dangerous, mm-hmm. and because sometimes when the tide turns and the boats are not steady, you're reeling and rocking, and things do happen. That was dangerous, but we didn't have sense enough to be afraid of anything like that.
What was some of the mischief that a young man had a chance to, and I'm not trying to incriminate.
No. I guess I was one of the good guys because I had a pretty good name all around. It's hard for me. We would, again, going back to, I spoke up about Mr. Solomon's house, and I growing up a Catholic, he had all kind of fruit trees in his yard, and tangerine trees, and orange trees, and kumquats. And the trees would be loaded down with different citrus fruit. And we knew we weren't supposed to go in there. He had a big fence there. But we, at nighttime, we'd run in and grab one off the tree and run back to the street. You know, he probably did the same thing about it. And the same thing with other people. Houses, they had these oranges and they would fall and rot or whatever. And peach trees. In Old Town, I know where we live, we had fig trees. We had three different types of fig trees in our yard. We had we call them Japanese plum, loquats. We had several of those in the yards. And we had something that you don't even see anymore unless you see it in the store, guava trees. We had several different type guava trees, the big white ones, and we had the pink ones in the yard. And I mean, my grandmother had a little garden, and she grew different types of what I call it catnip tea and other type of teas that she grew. No big garden, but but you don't see none of that anymore. And I think maybe the paper mills have something to do with the guava trees, because the guava trees were one of my favorite fruit. I mean, that was a, you know. And you don't see any now. And several people had guava trees, and they had the guava trees grow. Some of the guavas were as large as some of the larger apples that you get. And they would preserve them and preserve the figs. Mm-hmm. But you don't see any of that now. And we'd go in people's yards and take them, and we weren't supposed to do it, but they wouldn't really punish us for doing it. Mm-hmm. That's probably the most mischievous thing that we've ever done.
And I know you moved up north. At what age was that again? When did you move up to Philadelphia?
I was 18 then, I think.
Okay.
I think it was.
Now, I know you came back periodically,
yes.
I guess, to see your family and just sort of on vacation. Mm-hmm. Did you ever spend much time in American Beach during its heyday?
Oh, definitely, yeah. Before I left, American Beach was the weekend stop. We used to go down. They had American Beach was... Oh gee, they had so many nice bed and breakfast places down there, and other smaller restaurants. We call them joints. And when American Beach, when that motel down there was A.L. Lewis Motel, when that was built around 1950, there wasn't a prettier motel on the island. The shrubberies, and it was well manicured, and it was absolutely gorgeous. And there was another place right across from the motel. We call it the Purple Castle. It looked like a Spanish type of design with a terracotta roof, and you could drive right through it. From Greg Street was the street on American Beach, right to the beach. And whoever owned it, it was a doctor. I don't know whether MD or PhD, but on the weekends he would have parties there, and you could his stairwell not a stairwell as such, but it was set up that you could sit out there, and he had bands playing and music playing and serving food to some of his guests. And it was a beautiful place. I think it started to deteriorate. I don't know if he had any family or not, but I'm told that there's a picture of it in the Boston Conservatory of Art. A picture of, they call it the Purple Castle. It was a beautiful home, beautiful. And a couple of the restaurants down there, they had different. They had, well, naturally, they had the blues on the jukebox, and they had jazz. We'd go sit and listen to some of the jazz artists there, and they had nice crab cake sandwiches, or fish sandwiches, or hamburger, whatever you wanted. And on the weekends, you couldn't even move on America. Spent Friday night, the buses would start rolling in, and they wouldn't leave until Sunday, out of Georgia and Alabama, and some maybe farther away than that. And people from Jacksonville, it was crowded.
Mm-hmm.
American Beach was nice. There was much more homes there then than what it is now.
Mm-hmm.
I think the price of things have really... affected everybody. You know, back then you didn't need as much money to live on the beach. Back then you could buy a lot on. I remember when we first bought our home here in 88, I could have bought a lot on Fletcher for probably $50,000.
Hmm.
Now, I don't know what it is now, but later on it became $750,000, $800,000, $1 million some lots on the beachfront. But we didn't take advantage of that, but we didn't do too bad, I guess.
You mentioned the activity.
Hang on.